This is this is the dangerous hour, isn't it?
It's when the blood flow to your stomach is compromising the blood flow to your brain.
Yes.
And there's that danger that you just might become unconscious sitting out there. We'll hope not. 105, right on the number. All right, we're going to talk about bipolar disorder now. I wrote the Good Mood, Bad Mood because I wanted to write about bipolar disorder. And it was kind of a long, drawn-out event for me. And that was providentially good. I say that the fact that it took me 5 publishers and 5 years to finally get it done meant that there was research that was being done at the time that would be published during that 5-year period that would eventually find its way into my book, that if I'd have published it, you know, earlier, it wouldn't have even been available. So that was an act of God. I'm glad for it. I wrote the book because I'd gotten involved in teaching about bipolar disorder because Randy Patton said that he'd been getting a flood of requests about questions of it. This was in the 1990s. It just seemed like there were more people showing up in counseling with the label of bipolar disorder and who would be saying things like, the reason why I can't do any different than I'm doing right now is because the doctor tells me I have bipolar disorder. And so he wanted to know what, you know, the real medical facts of the matter were. When I set out to write the book, I did write probably 15 chapters about bipolar disorder. But when I finally landed with Shepherd Press, they told me that if they were going to publish the book, I was going to have to write about depression as well, which meant that I wasn't going to be able to write as much about bipolar disorder. And the reason why they said it was because they didn't think they could sell a 15-chapter book about bipolar disorder. And they thought that if we wrote about depression as well, we'd have a ghost of a chance to publish and sell it. Well, that was providential as well, because the truth of the matter is, what I'll tell you is that the majority of people who are being diagnosed with bipolar disorder start out with a diagnosis of depression. And so to understand depression was vitally important to understanding the growth of bipolar disorder. When I wrote it, there was a delay of a year before they even wanted to start with it. And I wrote 12 chapters, sent it in, and they gasped. They really didn't like it. And they sent it back, and then they hooked me with Jay Yuntz, a fine fellow and a good friend, and he would read each chapter as I wrote it. He didn't edit. He just told me when he thought I was driving off a cliff. And I made it to chapter 13. I still hadn't written anything about bipolar disorder in the book, and he announced that he thought the book was long enough. And I said, whoa, wait a minute here. As I recall, I signed up to write this book so I could write about bipolar disorder. And he allowed that I could write a couple of chapters as appendices and put them in the back of the book. And I was a first-time author and realized that I really didn't have a whole lot of power in the situation, so I couldn't, you know, jump up and down and refuse. And so I wrote them. And fortunately, Ted Tripp, who owns Shepherd Press, he read the book, read the 2 chapters, said, no, they have to go inside the book, which was a great thing. Another good thing about it was that Sue Lutz, who was the editor, a fine editor, and was enjoyable to work with, told me, having read the document, she said, before she edited it, she said that you have to footnote everything. Nobody's going to believe you if you say this. You have to footnote everything. And so I did. But then she also told Shepherd Press that they had to put the footnotes at the bottom of the page. So, and not use them as endnotes, because nobody looks at endnotes. They just power on through the book. So that's about the book. I wrote the book because I wanted to talk about bipolar disorder. So what do we know about bipolar disorder? There we are. All right. What can I tell you about bipolar disorder? The question is in the 1980s and the 1990s, was there an epidemic? When I started practicing medicine in 1975, the annual incidence of bipolar disorder in the United States was 1 in 1,000. That's not very many people. 0.1 or 0.01 or something like that. And it wasn't bipolar disorder then. When I graduated from medical school, bipolar disorder was manic depression, which they changed, saying that they wanted to make it distinct from schizophrenia. I always thought that manic depression was quite distinct from schizophrenia. I had no trouble telling the difference between the two. And I thought manic depression sort of told you exactly what was going on with the individual. And at the time, it wasn't difficult to recognize. If you've met someone who's manic, who's in the state of mania, you don't forget it. Have any of you seen It's a Mad, 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 Mad World? 1, 2, 3, 4. You know, the problem with aging is that eventually all the movies that you've seen don't matter anymore. I would suggest that you go home and rent on Netflix It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. A bunch of very funny comedians. Jonathan Winters is the embodiment of mania. He exhibits what you would say would be mania in the movie. Another good example is Robin Williams. You know, a funny man who came to a very tragic and sad end. Who it's like Good Morning Vietnam. I don't see the movie. I just see him, you know, announcing that on the radio. And you, at times you would listen to him, and he would talk really fast. He would always be funny. He was funny to listen to, and that would sort of look like mania. I remember the first manic patient that I saw was a gentleman who was a salesman. He was being viewed by us as medical students, and he was in a conversation with his physician who was taking care of him at the LaRue Carter Hospital. He had not slept for days. That was a first criteria. He talked 100 miles an hour. My wife says that was sort of what I sounded like in the first hour, powered by Starbucks. But anyway, he talked really fast. He was talking like a man who was afraid that if he quit talking, that nobody would let him speak again. You know, he couldn't let a word get in edgewise. He told us about some very grandiose business plans that he had, that would involve him buying lots of real estate and business things, spending lots of money. He was concerned that if he didn't get out of the hospital that day, that he would lose considerably large amounts of money. And so his goal was to convince us that he needed to get out so he could get his business deals done. Saw him a week later, and he sat in the interview quiet as a church mouse, really didn't have very much to say. At that point in time, I think he'd been on lithium for a week. And he was somewhat embarrassed if physician brought up the business issues that he had raised earlier. And he did go home shortly after that on lithium. But the main concern of his attending physician that he'd soon quit taking it and would return eventually in the same shape that he came in. And that's bipolar disorder in the 1970s up to 1980. In 1980, Robert Smith Spitzer guided the revision of the DSM-3. And in it, he changed the name for bipolar disorder, added a bunch of categories with it, including bipolar disorder 2. I often say this wasn't a conspiracy, but I think they meant well, but what they did was explode the diagnosis of bipolar disorder, because by changing the criteria, they made it easier to make the diagnosis. It was harder to make the diagnosis when it was just manic depression. So probably not an epidemic, although I think it went from 0.1% to depending on who you talk to, anywhere from 2 to 5 to 8% of the population with a label of bipolar disorder at any given time. The reason why it happened was the changing criteria. The real problem is born out of our need as physicians and as people to fix people. You know, that's my job. My dad told me when I was young that I should go to college because he said I wasn't mechanically inclined. My dad was a union steam fitter. He worked on large industrial chillers on huge buildings for 30 years for Carrier Air Conditioning. And I was proud of him. But he would look at me and say, don't think you're mechanically inclined. When I got into college, I got a job running a printing press that I could take apart completely, put it on both sides of the frame, and put it all back in together. And I would remind him of that on occasion. And the truth of the matter, I would later tell him that, the truth of the matter is that we're both mechanics. I just work on more complicated machinery than you do. And his response to that was, and he said, and yeah, you bury your mistakes. So, my dad spent his whole life fixing things, and boy, that's what I do. You know, people come in the office, and I can see up to 35 of them a day sometimes, and they come in, and they open their mouths, and what are they telling me? They have a problem. And what do they expect when they leave? They want a solution. So my mind works in fix-it sort of mode. And so it is in great measure for medicine. Patients come in and they struggle. If they come in and they say they're depressed, most of us would eventually write them a prescription for an antidepressant, I suspect, or try to get them to go talk to someone. If they didn't improve, we would encourage them to go talk to someone, perhaps change the drug, increase the dose, add a second, add a third, or whatever. And eventually, they might end up in a psychiatrist's office, and that psychiatrist would look at them and say, well, the problem is that you've been given the wrong diagnosis. You have bipolar disorder too. You're not just depressed. You have bipolar disorder too. Looking at some of the side effects, because, well, the patients who are who end up in a psychiatrist's office and are depressed universally are taking antidepressants when they get there, and the side effects of the antidepressants will mimic the diagnosis of hypomania. Well, the next problem associated with making the diagnosis of depression and bipolar disorder is, one, you have to diagnose depression. And we talked last hour about the subjective nature of making a diagnosis of depression. No way to validate it. It's my guess is as good as yours. The really sad part of the DSM-5 criteria when it comes to depression is that research tells us that at least half of physicians or nurse practitioners or physician assistants who make the diagnosis, those of us who are in that process, do not use the DSM-5 criteria to make the diagnosis. They just wing it. It's their gestalt opinion. And what's really even worse about that is that they're at least right 60% of the time. That was a joke. It's really bad when you have to tell people when the jokes are. So, and I don't tell people. I don't tell them. Maybe you notice that. I don't tell them very much. And the reason why is because I can't. I've had my friends tell me not to. If I could tell jokes, I'd probably be on late night television and I wouldn't have gone to medical school or any of that. You guys are almost comatose, aren't you? Yeah. There is the similar problem. The subjective criteria issue is the same for bipolar disorder as it is for depression. We don't have a validating test. In order to get it, you have to have the following criteria. You have to have a period of more than 1 week of improved mood. You have to have irritable, inflated sense of self-esteem. This is where the individual who is telling you that they want to buy the car wash they work at, and you're telling them that, really that's probably not a very good idea since they only have $200 in the bank, and they look at you and, their thinking is, it's a lot like a card I saw in an office once, and it was one of these cubicle farm type offices, and the card was on the wall of one of the cubicle offices, and it was a picture from The Sixth Sense, the movie with Bruce Willis, and the little boy saw dead people. And it was a picture of Bruce, the psychiatrist or psychologist, talking to the little boy. And, in that scene, he says, "I see dead people." And he's got this serious look on his face. But the quote underneath it says, "I see stupid people." That it was, him standing up and looking around in the office. And that was pretty much the expression you get from people who are manic. And they're explaining to you all their high-flying ideas and the things that they're going to do. And you say, "Oh, you can't do that." And they just look at you like if you were as smart as I was or I am, then you'd understand me. And the reason why you don't understand me is because you're stupid. So they have an inflated sense of self-esteem. Yes, and then they're easily distracted with a pressing need to get things done. They can't stay focused on any one thing. They kind of bounce from thing to thing. It's like my cousin says, squirrel. You know, you see the squirrel and off you run. They spend money. Let's see here now. Moving on. Yes, they spend money that they don't have. You know, $30,000 on credit cards. I can remember one patient that was hospitalized because family was trying to protect him financially. And the reason why they were trying to protect him is because he was trying to buy up all the real estate on both sides of 38th Street in Indianapolis. And I think that's about 30 miles of street. And the guy was fairly prosperous and probably could have carried on for a while, even though it would have ruined him financially. So they had him institutionalized and away from his bank account. And they also make disastrous sexual and moral choices. That's Britney Spears writ large. Or who is the guy who played in National? Yes, Nicolas Cage, who got married for 4 days recently. Yeah, makes you wonder what they were drinking. Yeah, they were married for 4 whole days and then filed for divorce or filed for an annulment. Make disastrous sexual or moral choices. Mania is followed by depression, and a diagnosis of depression is required for bipolar disorder 1. Now, Tom was a patient that I took care of, and his story fits. He's a 30-year-old white male, came to my office after he'd been cared for in the emergency room. He was taken there by his family after he became involved in a fight at work. Tom believed that he had been sent on a mission by God. It sounds like the Blues Brothers, doesn't it? To help the nation Israel. Now, this was in the middle of the first Iraq war, and he was watching television, and he would relate to the emergency room that he'd heard the voice of God tell him that there was a conspiracy going on at the Walmart where he worked and that he should go down and fight against it. Which he did, which was very unusual for Tom. Tom had been an exemplary employee. Unfortunately, it resulted in him eventually being fired, got him into the emergency room, and eventually into my office. They didn't hospitalize him. They put him on Seroquel, which is an atypical antipsychotic and makes you sleepy at night. And he started sleeping. By the time I saw him, he was really not doing badly. You know, he kind of leveled out. Probably would have done well if he'd just taken Seroquel the rest of his life. Now, you know, the truth of the matter is statistically that just because you have one psychotic episode does not. My English teacher would vomit. It doesn't mean that you'll have another. There's a 30 to 50% chance you'll never have another psychotic episode. And you know, that's the reason why most people who get stuck on Seroquel and other atypical antipsychotics quit them and don't want to take them. Unfortunately for Tom, this was his third trip to the rodeo. He'd been in situations just like this 2 other times. And as I took care of him, he did rather well as long as he slept. He returned to work at a different company. And at times, I could wind him down to about 12 and a half milligrams of Seroquel at night, and we'd maintain him on it. It's next to nothing. When he would start to wind back up, his wife would note it, call me, and we'd jack his dose back up to 50 or so until he wound back down. And I took care of him for a good while, doing just exactly that. Eventually, he would come to me and tell me, you know, I'm doing really well now. Could I please quit my medicine? And you know, if it was his first time, I might have had a heart for the idea. But, you know, I would look at Tom, who was a Christian. He was a believer who had 7 children. And my response to him would say, sure, Tom, but who's going to support your wife and kids when you get fired at this job? And he would think about it a little while and he would say, you're right. And he would go on and take the medicine. I always admired him for that. He saw his responsibility, knew what it was, and would continue to take his medicine as ordered. That's a typical case of bipolar mania. You know, if you're really interested in watching me counsel somebody with bipolar disorder, you can go to ibcd.org and you can send them some money and they will send you a 6 hours of me counseling a couple, the husband of which has manic depression. They are actors, but they did a good job. We all did a good job. So you could go look at that. That would be helpful to you as well. But Tom's story fits the whole idea of bipolar disorder 1. Now, how do we move from manic depression to bipolar disorder? Well, it is involved in the birth of modern medicine. You know, from the time of Hippocrates until present, medicine has struggled to understand pathology at the cell level. And this has been extremely true of mental disorders. And until 1900, I would say it's been pretty hopeless. The prevailing theory in medicine until that time was the good and bad humor deal with yellow bile, black bile, phlegm, and blood. And that went on until William Perkin, and the date up there is wrong, it's 1856. William Perkin was an organic chemist. When I was a young man, when I was headed off to college, smart young men went to medical school. At least most of us were, anyway. And the reason why was it was the way up and out. You know, it was into a profession. And today it's engineering. I don't know if you'd noticed that, but most people who are looking for the way up and out, they go to engineering school someplace because that's a lot more inviting than some aspects of medicine is today, frankly. Well, back in 1856, it was organic chemistry. You know, if you were looking for the way up and out, you were going to be an organic chemist, and William Perkin was. I believe he was in England, and he was looking for a way to figure out how to make dye out of coal tar. And the dye was going to be used to color clothes. And so he was working around at it. And initially he made a dye that was black, which made him absolutely no money because at the time it didn't cost any. It wasn't hard to dye clothes black. That was not a problem. What he was really looking for was purple. Purple was expensive. The reason why purple dye was expensive and the reason why only kings and rich people wore it was because it was made from the snot and the slime of snails, rather small snails, someplace around the Mediterranean. And you had to harvest a lot of them in order to get a little bit of dye, which made it a rather rare and precious commodity. Well, William Perkin figured out eventually how to make purple dye out of coal tar. And he became a millionaire, and people started wearing purple left and right without regard to their financial status. And he steps off the scene. He's done. And this is like one of those historical, you know, long historical programs on television, miniseries. You know, you have characters, and they do something, and they're out, and you're into the next 10 years. Well, the next guy up was Paul Ehrlich, and he picks up that purple dye, and guess what he did with it? You know, all you medical personnel in the room would know it was Gram stain. Yes, it was the Gram stain. And what it did was allowed you to look at bacteria and secretions from people and look at cells. He figured out, and other people with him, that cells actually respired, that they were alive, that they took in the dye into the cell and they could look at it. And he started in about 1886 staining samples from inmates at the insane asylum in Berlin called the Charité Insane Asylum. His statement about it all is that he felt it should be possible to find artificial substances which are really curative for certain diseases, not merely palliatives acting favorably on one symptom or another. Not just make you feel better, cure you. That was what Ehrlich's goal was. Now, what did Ehrlich find when he was staining all those things? Well, what he found out was that half the people in the Charité mental hospital weren't insane at all. They had tertiary syphilis. And a symptom of tertiary syphilis is a destruction of the brain, which results in psychosis. And so half the people in that hospital had an infectious disease, which was like kicking the door open in darkness. You know, somehow we could prevent half the incidence of insanity that existed in 1860 if we just knew how to cure the disease. Well, actually, we knew how to prevent it. You know, you just didn't have to catch it. But unfortunately, there were lots of people who weren't all about prevention. And so Ehrlich spent the next, I think, maybe 50 years working on arsenic to try to turn it into something that you could inject into people that would kill spirochetes but not kill humans. And eventually, on the 606th try, he invented salvarsan, which was the first antimicrobial drug that would kill spirochetes and which the patient could survive the treatment. And with that, he cured syphilis. That was an amazing day in medicine. Have any of you seen the movie I Am Legend? Will Smith? That's what it's about. You know, it is Paul Ehrlich over again. And what was it, the 1800th try or the 1100th try when he's trying to figure out what the virus was so that he could cure the zombies? That was what that was about. When he announced the number, they were talking to you about what went on when Paul Ehrlich was doing exactly the same thing and discovered Salvarsan. So what do I say about medicine and counseling? Truth is never an enemy. Truth is never an enemy to biblical counseling or in the pursuits of understanding and curing disease. Truth is no enemy in medicine. Now, what happened to psychiatry at that point? Boy, that was an open door, wasn't it? Suddenly we understood pathology. We could prevent half the people in the country from getting a disease that would result in their needing to be in an insane asylum. Well, I'll tell you what happened to it. A guy named Freud. Yes. Sigmund Freud. He turned psychiatry away from pathology-based explanations and descriptions of disease to theoretical descriptions of disease. I assume that Freud must have hated his mother. Or at least he didn't get along with her, because just about everything that he explained had something to do with an overbearing parent, and generally it was the mother. Every kind of mental ill disposition was due to a difficult set of parents. And by 1950, psychiatry was in the swamp. It was so bad that you could hire actors to go play parts, and they could go present themselves to emergency rooms or to mental institutions, and they could play the part of an insane person and get admitted. You could get a diagnosis of depression in Detroit and get a different diagnosis in Los Angeles. And that was really why the DSM came into existence in the first place. What they really were looking for, and it wasn't a bad thought, was at least if someone was going to say you were depressed in Indianapolis, they would say you were depressed in Atlanta. They wanted reliability in the diagnosis. And I would tell you that they have, in some measure, achieved that. Reliability. But the problem is, of course, is that if you ask the same people the same 10 questions and get the same answer, that doesn't mean you're right. You can be reliably incorrect, reliably wrong. And unless you have a test that you can do that validates the diagnosis, then while it may be reliable, it may not be valid. That's the deal with diabetes. You know, you come in and tell me you're drinking 10 glasses of water to get through the night. You have them all lined up on the nightstand, and you're going to the bathroom to urinate all the time, and you're eating everything in sight and losing weight. Guess what I'm going to say that you have? You know, I'm going to say you have diabetes. Yeah, I'm not going to say you have athlete's foot. I'm going to say you have diabetes. The history is classic. Just about anybody could figure it out. But then you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to have the nurse come in and stick your finger and do an AccuCheck. And when it reads high, which means that somewhere north of 500, I have validated the diagnosis. We cannot do that for bipolar disorder. Neither can we do it for depression. We just don't have the test. We can't do it for most of the tests in the DSM. So the Diagnostic Statistic Manual of Mental Disorders was published in 1950 and brought a little order. The third revision, let's go back. The third revision came in 1980, and they added bipolar disorder in the place of mania. And the next thing that added to the explosion of the diagnosis of bipolar disorder was Prozac, launched in 1988. And the idea that this disease, depression, was caused by a chemical imbalance. Now let's look at the criteria, the categories for bipolar disorder today. The first one is, let's see, bipolar disorder, which is a 1, which is the old manic depression. It still occupies less than 1% of the population. You know, mania is fairly distinctive. To me, mania with regard to bipolar disorder is the same thing as normal sadness is in depression. You know, I can nail normal sadness 100% of the time. You know, all I got to do is ask the questions, and all you have to do is tell me when it started and what happened. Same thing could be said of mania. Always keep in mind that psychosis that accompanies mania can be caused by other things, which is why when somebody presents with mania, they need to be in an emergency room. Why? Because they need a good workup to make sure that they don't have some other cause, some other medical cause of the current issues that they had or they have. Then there's bipolar disorder 2, which is the largest of all those categories because the criteria is not difficult to meet. Cyclothymia is the third category, and it includes individuals who have a moderate episodes of sadness and alternate with moderate episodes of feeling good. You don't feel too good, you don't feel too bad, you just kind of wax and wane between the two. Then there is bipolar disorder caused by substance abuse, or that's medication-induced. These are the DSM-5 criteria. And then there's bipolar disorder due to another medical condition. And then finally, bipolar disorder, other specified bipolar disorder, or related disease. Now, this used to be the bipolar disorder not otherwise specified. That's an old trucking term. Whenever you say NOS, I worked at a trucking company all the way through college and all the way through medical school, and I was a billing clerk, and it was nuts and bolts NOS, nuts and bolts not otherwise specified. So they were shipping 1,000 of them. And so when you said bipolar disorder not otherwise specified, what you gave them was a place where they could put these people if they weren't certain what the diagnosis was. It gave them some laterality in making it. All right. Then important changes that came with the DSM-3 that made it easier to make the diagnosis. First, you no longer had to be in the hospital for a week in order to get the diagnosis. Prior to the 1980 revision to the DSM-3, if you were going to have a diagnosis of bipolar disorder, you had to have as disruptive an event in your life that put you in the hospital for a week. That was one of the criteria, which meant that the numbers were going to be smaller. Then the next thing is that the criteria for bipolar disorder is less restrictive. You can have the presence of one or more major depressive episodes, presence of at least one hypomanic episode, which we'll talk about in a minute. You can't have had a true manic episode. Once you have mania, you're not going to be in bipolar disorder 2. You'll either be in bipolar disorder 1 or some other category. So no mania. Then your symptoms can't be accounted for by another disorder or by some other drug. You know, a lot of folks will get labeled with bipolar disorder 2, and the real problem is they have opioid problems, or they have marijuana problems, or they have other substance abuse problems and amphetamine problems. And the truth of the matter is you're not supposed to make this kind of diagnosis until people are drug free for a specific period of time, so that you're not putting a diagnosis on them that really is due to the effects of the medication they're taking. Then the symptoms cause significant clinical distress or social impairment. I mean, it isn't the kind of thing, bipolar disorder 2, that is supposed to take you out of work, but it is supposed to make your work more difficult and your life a little more difficult. The key difference between bipolar disorder 1 and bipolar disorder 2 is the difference between mania and hypomania. Hypomania, you know, if you took Greek or if you took Greek and Latin derivatives, you know that hypo means below. And so it's less, you know, you're not quite as manic. And that's what hypomania is. It is supposed to look a little bit like mania, but it is not quite like it. It is a distinct period in which you have an elevated mood. Now, this only has to last 4 days. And it can be elevated to the extent that people just think that for once in your life you look happy and that maybe you're a little bit more goal-oriented at work, but it is different than what you have been. And during that period, you have to have some of the other things here. One is an increased inflated sense of self-esteem or grandiosity. I don't think it's on the quite on the level of frank mania. You also would have a decreased need for sleep. But it's not, I stay awake for 2 weeks. Manics can stay awake for days at a time. And that probably plays into the psychosis aspect of it. If I take anybody in this room and I keep you up for 3 days, guess what you start doing after about 3 days? Keep you awake, shine a bright light in your face, throw cold water on you every time you look like you get ready to go to sleep. That's what the Russians used to do. If they were wanting information from you, after about 3 days, you start hallucinating. You start seeing things and hearing things. That happens to anybody. It doesn't make any difference if you have any medical problem at all. These people can sleep 4 hours, get up, and they feel fine. Just because you do that also doesn't mean that you have hypomania, all right? But that's because there are some people, I've never been one, but who only sleep 4 hours a night and they feel just fine and they function well. And I wish, you know, what I really wish is that we had a 32 hour day. Yes, that's really what I'd like, a 32 hour day. Then I get some writing done then. People will be more talkative than usual or feel pressure to keep talking, have a flight of ideas. They too will be distractible. And they may have an increase in goal-directed activity at work, and they can also make bad decisions with regard to finances and moral sexual indiscretions. Now, this has to represent a change in their normal function level. It's generally not severe enough to cause marked impairment. And the important dividing line is the difference between hypomania and mania, just like with normal sadness and disordered sadness. This interesting quote, this is out of the DSM-5, hypomanic episodes that are clearly caused by somatic antidepressant treatment, medication, ECT, light therapy should not count toward a diagnosis of bipolar disorder 2. Now, what's the problem with that? What are they telling us? They're telling us that people who have to take medicine for depression may have episodes that look like hypomania. And most of the people who are going to get diagnosed with bipolar disorder 2 have already been diagnosed with depression and are most likely to be already taking medicine for it. That, I think, probably answers the question is, why do we have so many people with the label at this point in time? The problem with all of this is that people labeled with depression are on antidepressant medicine when they're labeled with bipolar disorder 2. And I've said instead of treating a new disease, we may simply be treating the side effects of a drug used to treat an old one. And I think that's really true. Now, the question is, how can we help these people? Example, case of a struggling young mother. I can remember the first bipolar 2 individual that I saw. I was working in a family practice office, and it was probably about 1992 or 93. And lady came in because she had a cold or sinus infection or something. Now, you know, how do I get from there to bipolar disorder? Well, you know, whenever I see people, I have to go through their whole medicine list. I need to know every drug you're taking because any drug I'm going to prescribe you could interact with any drug you might already be taking, and I need to know all of it. And I got down to it, and she was taking Depakote. And I looked at that and I said, do you have a seizure disorder? You know, the uninitiative me, you know, and she said, oh no, that's my mood stabilizer. And, you know, I got to chatting with her about it and she was on an antidepressant. And I said, well, what diagnosis are they giving you that for? And she said, for bipolar disorder, and which confused me even more because at the time I hadn't studied bipolar disorder very much and I didn't know about bipolar disorder too. I just knew what manic depression was. And I knew, and I said, well, have you had mania or anything like that? And she says, oh no, I haven't. And then I talked to her more about her life, and what I found out was that her underlying problem was that she had been abandoned by the father of her two children, her two young sons, who were both diagnosed with ADHD and who were both on amphetamine derivative medications for it. She worked full time in order to support her two kids because her father was not contributing anything to their maintenance. And she would come home at night and struggle because she was coming off of a full day's worth of work. And what did she have to do? She had to come home and do another full day's worth of work, you know, to take care of her children. And she had no help. She had no encouragement. She had very few prospects of it ever changing. And she had no hope. And I'll tell you, that was the source of her trouble. That was the source of her depression. And it wouldn't make any difference what combination of medicine they put her on. As long as her social situation stayed exactly the same, she was going to struggle. And the truth of the matter was, she didn't feel any better, and she was headed to a psychiatrist again, and the reason why she was going was because she didn't feel any better now on two medicines than she felt before she started taking any of them. And I would tell you that in cases like this, the solution is the same as it has always been in medicine, and that is we need to make a better diagnosis based on the most solid factual evidence that we can get. This lady was struggling with sadness over loss. She was struggling just with fatigue. You know, she was just plain tired. That was her problem. And this would be the kind of person that, honest to goodness, biblical counseling could help and the church could help. She had two boys that needed a dad. And yeah, we couldn't, you know, I'm not saying we could find her a husband, but we could certainly find men in the church who could be role models for these two boys and could help her with their raising, and people who could help her with her struggles to keep things together at home. So it starts with recognizing that the diagnosis of bipolar disorder is just as confusing today as the diagnosis of depression is. And I would tell you that the labels offer us no pathologic certainty and no ability to validate it. So, as disordered normal sadness is the key to understanding depression, so mania, hypomania, I think is the way to understand bipolar disorder and the dividing line between bipolar disorder 1 and bipolar disorder 2. In the absence of mania, my contention is that the diagnosis of bipolar disorder 2 is no more valid than the label of depression in the absence of disordered sadness. So we used to do the same thing with bipolar disorder and full-blown mania. Was the tool that we used to make the diagnosis certain. That's why there were so few people labeled with it prior to the 1980 revision of the DSM. And without that tool, we're back to the making a diagnosis based on little more than opinion. Little more than opinion. I would say that the first and most important thing that we can do to help people who struggle with bipolar disorder too is to deal with normal sadness over grieving due to loss. And biblical counseling has, I think, a great opportunity to do that. In order to do that, you're going to deal with all aspects of biblical counseling with individuals who come. They struggle with sadness and sorrow and loss and anger and fear and worry and selfishness, self-orientation. They struggle with idolatry, and they need grace, and they need hope and confidence and repentance and faith and sanctification and salvation and perseverance. They need all those things. And we can show them those things out of the Word of God. Now, who's responsible for whose behavior? That's a good question, isn't it? If I have bipolar disorder 1 and mania, and I buy $30,000 worth of stuff while I'm manic, who's responsible for that? Is it my credit card company? Is it my poor spouse who is signed up on my credit card with me? Well, you know, that's a good question. Are these people just not responsible for it because they have a disease and they are doomed to do it because they have a disease? So if an individual commits sin while they're manic, what do you guys think? I'm not being rhetorical now. What? They're responsible. That's good. Where do you think that sin comes from? Does it come from their disease? What? What? Heart. Yes. Oh, you guys are good. You're making great progress in the study of biblical counseling. Yes, it comes out of their own heart. I listened to Ed Welch talk about this once, and it was about a patient that he had. And it was a couple who came to him for counseling, and they... He had had a manic episode and committed adultery, And they had separated 10 years earlier. And they had not divorced, but they had remained apart for 10 years. And after 10 years, for whatever reason, the wife decided that she wanted to reconcile, but she wanted some counseling before they got to that. And so they showed up in Ed's office. And so Ed listened to the story, and the guy starts out by saying, you know, who he was. And then he said, the reason why we're here is because we were separated. And the reason why we're separated because I'm bipolar. And when I was having a manic episode, I committed adultery. Now, what do you think Ed told him? Well, he didn't tell him that it came out of his bipolar disorder, did he? No. No, he told him that, no, actually, what you committed was sinful, and it came right out of your heart. And what was really remarkable was the guy listened to him and said, okay. he was agreeable. And so they went on through counseling and did rather well, and they reconciled and moved back in together, and he promptly had another manic episode. But you know what? This time he didn't commit adultery. And actually, he didn't get to do anything much wrong at all, because there were men in his church who knew him and who were tasked with standing around him and looking out for his soul. And they kept track of him. That's what they did. They kept track of him until the doctor got him calmed back down. And he made it all the way through that manic episode without committing any known sin. And Ed would tell you, and I would as well, that sin committed while you are manic, you're responsible for. And so, Dr. Welch's patient. What about medication? What should we do about medicine? I can tell you this, that most people who take medicine for mania don't like it, and they don't want to take it, and most often will quit. Every once in a while, it turns out well for them. I remember talking to a lady who had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and was placed on medicine, and she really did have a good history for it. I mean, it wasn't a frivolous one. She had had a full-blown 2 weeks' worth of mania all over the place, and but once again, we don't have a validating test, they went by her history. They put her on medicine, and she took it dutifully for about a year. And then finally went back to the psychiatrist and said, look, I really don't want to take this anymore, and I don't think I need to. And he refused to help her to quit. You know, he just said, I'm not going to do it. And so what do you think she did? She quit anyway, yeah. And that was 20 years ago, and she didn't have another manic episode. And so she was right. And that's 30 to 50% of the time. It isn't all the time. And truly, when you put people on medicine for psychosis, I think the standard of care is probably keep them on it for a year. And after a year, if you're not convinced that they have schizophrenia, or you think there's any question that maybe they don't have bipolar disorder, then taking them off of it, as long as they're surrounded by a good group of people to keep track of them, is a reasonable medical thing, so that they don't take this medicine for 20 years and not need it at all. On the other hand, people like Tom, who've had three episodes of psychosis, three episodes of mania, at this point in time, as best we understand it, they're probably better served by continuing to take their medicine, because if they stop it, eventually they're likely to have another episode. So I'd say bipolar disorder 1, people should be taking it. Now, when it comes to bipolar disorder 2, that's, as far as I'm concerned, a completely different matter. I think the benefit of taking medicine for people with the label of bipolar disorder 2 is questionable. And the medicine has considerable side effects. If they're not having episodes of frank mania, I don't know how much good it does them. And I think they're probably better served by counseling with someone. In either case, taking medicine is a what kind of issue did I say it was earlier today? Christian liberty. Yeah, it's a Romans 14 issue. It's not a matter of right or wrong. It's a matter of whether it's wise or unwise. And as always, the primary goal of biblical counseling starts in 2 Corinthians 5:9. I want to glorify God with my life more than I want to breathe. I'm doing okay. Yes. 105:2. I'm doing fine. So the main goal of counseling is not to get people off medicine. The main goal of counseling is for you to lead them in a way in their lives so that they can glorify God with their lives. And the greatest, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest benefit to people with mood disorders is to discerning between normal and disordered sadness at the outset and making sure that people with normal sadness end up in good counseling as opposed to medication. And as far as I'm concerned as well, that people with disordered sadness end up in good counseling. All right. Well, you know, it is 1:54 and I could answer questions for 6 minutes. Anybody have a question about this, about bipolar disorder? Yes. You know, I watched about the first 15 minutes of it, and that was the end. Now, I'll tell you this about it, the observation that I made about it, and I think it is entirely true when you're dealing with people with schizophrenia, is that often we get the mistaken notion that they are you cannot educate them. The thing that came, that I think that man's story, and I met a guy who knew him actually, was that he was brilliant. He was really smart. And so you should never look at people who are struggling with emotional struggles or mental disorders or whatever and assume they can't learn. That is the soft bigotry of low expectations. Yeah. So expect more. They'll do more. Your question. 2 Corinthians 5:9, I think. Yes, 2 Corinthians 5:9. Therefore also we have as our ambition, whether at home or absent, to be pleasing to him. And my sentence that I generate out of that is I want to glorify God with my life more than I want to breathe. I told that to a counselee early on who had anorexia, who did rather well. And I've told it to every counselee I've ever counseled since then. And I've said it so much around the country that people think that it's in a translation. And I've had somebody write me and ask me what translation of the Bible it occurred in. I said, no, that's my translation. Yes. Okay. When I said gestalt, I just meant you're looking at them and making a diagnosis. I wasn't referring to gestalt therapy. All right, you know, and that was back on making the diagnosis, either using the criteria or not using the criteria. And a lot of people will make a diagnosis of depression. You come in and tell them your sad story and you say, I'm depressed. They don't go through the criteria. They just look at you, listen to your story and say, yeah, you're depressed. That would be the gestalt. I just look at you and you look depressed, so I call you depressed. It wasn't a reference to gestalt therapy. Yes. We don't know it. There is some pathology that I've read about that is similar to schizophrenia for people who have bipolar disorder. There's some pathologic threads that are in between the two. I think since we're actually honing in on schizophrenia more, that eventually that information will become useful when it comes to dealing with bipolar disorder. That's what I think. But right now and it puts us, when I said earlier in that first lecture, you know, you have to make a judgment, but don't be judgmental, you know, or unkind or not merciful. But yeah, doctors make judgments. Kevin Carson's brother, Craig, and, you know, talking about making diagnoses of children. He's a school superintendent, and he has a diagnosis that he calls SARS, and what that is, something ain't right. You know, that's his diagnosis. I don't know what's wrong with that kid, but something ain't right. So, are any more questions? Questions? If not, we're done. Okay. Well, all right. Yes.
Do you have any knowledge of treating schizophrenia with fasting? And that's based on documentary I saw.
With fasting?
Yes.
No, I don't. That won't keep me from making a comment, though, will it? No. No, you know, there have been some people who talk about ketogenic diets for treating seizure disorders. And, you know, and I think maybe at some point in time, I have seen some people talk about that kind of dieting that is supposed to help schizophrenia. And that's the end of it. That's about all I know. If you want to know what I think about schizophrenia, I think the lecture is up at ibc.org that I've given about schizophrenia elsewhere. You can find it there. And if you can't, you can always email me and I will point you in a direction where you can find it. It probably is up at Wheelersburg Baptist in Wheelersburg, Ohio. And I have an hour-long lecture in which I talk about schizophrenia. Yes?
One more. When you know that you work with drug abuse issues and addictive behavior, how does that fit in with the brain disease model versus responsibility?
Okay, so how does substance abuse and fit in with a brain disease model and personal responsibility? Are you talking about like someone who becomes an opioid addict or an alcoholic or drunk, addicted to amphetamines? Is that what you're talking about?
Any addictive type of
No, I think it's you make a choice. Nobody forces you to put alcohol in your mouth. Nobody forces you to take opioids. Do I think that they are substances which come to have an amazing grip on individuals? The answer is yes, but the initial responsibility for sticking it in your mouth belongs to you. And, you know, I am the single most parsimonious writer of opioids in the state in which I live. You know, I probably don't write 5 prescriptions a year for them. You have to meet criteria for me to write you a script for Vicodin, and the criteria are you have a broken bone, you have a burn, or you're dying of cancer. Those are my 3 criteria. And the reason why is that if I can't see an end to writing it, I'm not going to start. You know, never write an addictive substance, a prescription for an addictive substance for a patient if you don't know when you're going to stop. It's the Norman Schwarzkopf rule of writing pain medicine. Does anybody remember who Norman Schwarzkopf was? Yes, he was a general of the army. And he said about going to war, don't go to war if you don't know how to get back. Now, you can't always do that. You know, that's not always true. But if you have time to think about it, you shouldn't go to war unless you have an exit strategy. And then he said, if you do go to war, take overwhelming force. Don't take half the army. Take the whole army. Go squash them and squash them in a hurry. And that's what I say about pain medicine. I said, like, if I'm going to write a narcotic for you, I want to know the day I'm going to stop it. Because I've heard people say that at 5 days, your risk for being an addict to oxycodone is real. 5 days. And most of the prescriptions get written for 30 days, you know? And it's like, well, I've just given you a chance to have 2 complicating problems in life, whatever it brought you in to see me, and now the ability to become addicted that I've given you. So, you know, I've said that since the 1990s, and I was criticized bitterly for it. I mean, it cost me to hold to that. I had a physician sit me down when I was an intern, and he said, the state of Indiana and the federal government's going to give you a license and a permit to write for narcotics. Your goal in life should be to see to it that no one ever ends up being an addict because you wrote the script. And that's what he told me. And you know what? I have lived by that for 45 years now. And during the 1990s, when Purdue Pharma was paying for all the special education that doctors and nurses got, which taught us about the 5th vital sign? Oh, yes, that we should reduce everybody's pain thing to zero. I was saying, no, this is not right. And there were articles written that talked about doctors like me who said I was torturing people and stuff like that. Well, now what they're talking about are the 70,000 people who are going to die this year from narcotic overdoses. So anyway, I ranted. I'm sorry. At any rate, I won't write for much more than 2 days worth of anything for anybody. And fortunately, we have the thing in Indiana where you can go look and see if they're getting it from somebody else, too, so that you're not writing dual prescriptions for anything. Did I answer your question in all of that? Okay. All right.